know, it's bloody hard coming up with the start bits of the podcast. Always trying to think of a smart way to kick it all off. An introduction which will cast its mark and allow you a smug upward curl of your lip in admiration for all our hard work put in to craft such an adroit, cunning and artful intro akin to this, which, until now, was all said without using a solitary E. Welcome to the Failing Writers Podcast.
John, I really enjoyed last week's episode, our Halloween episode.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it opened my eyes a little bit to the world of ghostly writing.
Oh, well, I'm pleased.
And ghostly things.
And one thing I didn't ask you, and we'll save this for Christmas if the answer is yes. You haven't ever had any sort of weird encounters, have you?
Well, let's save this for Christmas, John.
That is exciting.
But the answer's no. I'll take it out, no. But I'll string you along a little bit. Not directly. No, not directly.
Okay. But you've got a little tale.
It's interesting doing a bit of research to thinking over the last week since last episode. I've been looking, just you know, putting the feelers out to see what a ghost story would look like that I might write.
Mm.
And just some of the stuff that's out there. Not the fictional stuff, but like you said, like the urban myths and the thing. Some truth in them. And they're slightly, you know, from like Victorian time. You know, we're talking about Victorian ghost stories and stuff. And that era is just full of seances and kind of...
Yeah, they were obsessed.
But they were on the edge of scientific discovery of the Industrial Revolution, of kind of, it was like the new renaissance of science explaining everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And part of that was that supernatural thing that there was something just on the other side. So it's a fascinating little rabbit hole to come down to.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting writing that at some stage.
Yeah.
Although I'll probably leave it to, you know, like the week before. I'm going to try not to.
It made me think back to last... I mean, it doesn't seem 5 minutes since last Halloween, actually, when we had Sonia Dean.
I know. Yeah, God, that was a year ago. That's weird.
And obviously, her spooky writings and stuff.
Mm. Hey, Tom, we should mention that Sonia Dean now has her own podcast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's very good, actually.
She hosts Publishing Rodeo, The Good, The Bad, and The Bloody Ugly.
It's, I would say, I think our podcast and her podcast kind of go hand in hand and cover two sides of a coin.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
In that Sonia and Scott are quite competent writers. No, but theirs is very much focused on the publishing industry.
Yeah, they're the kind of real deal, aren't they? They've been there and done it.
Yeah.
And got the publishing deal.
But no, it's really, if you're after something else to listen to in the writing field, it's a bit more about publishing and a little bit no holds barred view of the industry.
Yeah.
And one of you with kind of knowledge from the inside.
Yeah, yeah.
It's definitely worth listening. Definitely worth listening.
Yeah. If you love all that insight into the proper, full on, hardcore world of books and publishing, yeah, you will definitely want to check that out. And Sonia is a delight, as you will know if you listen to her episode on our podcast. She is incredibly honest.
Yeah.
Sometimes maybe a bit too honest.
That's great though, isn't it? That's what you want. Yeah, you want to get underneath, exactly. So it's not all just niceness.
Yeah, she cuts through the bullshit brilliantly.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's our little recommendation.
Absolutely.
Today.
Publishing Rodeo podcast. Anyway, moving on to this week's episode, John. A lot of people will be taking up the mantle of NaNoWriMoWriMo.
Yeah.
National Novel Writing Month, and
it does seem like a thing now, doesn't it? I think a lot of people get on board.
Yeah,
I was going to ask you, Tommy, where do you sit on the whole word count thing? Do you know what I mean? Have you ever actually tried to maintain a sort of a target word count?
Not religiously or strictly, which can be obviously seen quite clearly in my output and levels of. But I mean, I think even just, we've said this before years ago, I think when we first started, about any target is a good target. If you set yourself 200 words a day, it means you're actually going to sit down and write something.
Have you ever done that?
Yes, probably recently-ish, sort of saying, right, you need to be doing 1,000 words a day. That's how I started with the current kids' book that I'm writing, was just to make sure I was just doing 1,000 words a day. That's had a little bit of a hiatus, but you know,
there's been a hiccup.
Yeah, a little bit.
These things happen.
But it does mean it moves. Yeah, yeah. It moves on, and the word count seems less daunting, because I think it's that thing, isn't it? If you can start, something and get excited about the idea. Do 2,000 or 3,000 words very easily, if you like. Kind of just comes out.
They're always the easiest, I find, those first ones. Yeah.
If you don't keep on it, you know, 3:30, you might do a little bit, do a bit more, and you've not got this, I need to do a chunk every day.
Mm.
Before long, you think, oh God, there's still like, I'm nowhere with this.
Mm.
Obviously, you feel like it's not moving. So I think it does yourself a favour, doesn't it? Just kind of.
I think so.
And it's back to the thing of accepting that it doesn't need to be brilliant stuff. It just needs to get done.
Just right
the first
forward.
Draft just needs to be. Forward. So it almost is just about word count.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't think
Do you know
so.
What's good? The for me, the best thing about NaNoWriMo, in fact, I was thinking about this just yesterday, because I have actually been writing, Tommy. I've been trying to get a head start on NaNoWriMo. Because this is my logic.
It's meant to be in the month. How does that work?
Well, because this is how my logic works. If my enthusiasm peters out during November, at least I'll have had this few days of October and I'll have them in the
That's
bag.
That's not right. That's cheating. That's basically like going, right, I'm going to run the 100 metres, but I found what I'm going to do, just in case I get tired near the end, I'm going to start walking 20 seconds before the starting pistol goes.
Yeah.
And I'll just I'll maybe get 20 metres in just to give myself a little head start.
See, it's pretty clever.
Actually, no, when I think about it, that's, yeah.
But anyway, sorry, I was talking about the fact that, so I was writing my murder mystery book, and I know that this is going to sound ridiculous, but here's my amazing bit of writing advice based on the fact that I think NaNoWriMo is a good idea. There's so much advice online and in podcasts and in books about learning to write, isn't there?
Yeah.
And there's some great ones, you know?
There's like some very good ones.
How to improve your craft and how to improve your productivity. And there's some really interesting stuff to be said. But here's what I've realized. There is no substitute, not a single one, for just fucking writing. You will learn more just sitting down and writing for an hour than you will reading a book about writing for an hour. And I'm not saying, you know, you should never do that, because I've, you know, I feel like I've learned a lot from books like that, without doubt. But you will never learn quicker or harder than by just attempting to write.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's really obvious. But it's like we're always just looking for a little shortcut or a little gem of insight or something, do you know what I mean? That's going to transform.
You always are. You always have been. You've always been looking for that. You like when we have people on, you're like, so tell us, what's the one
what's the
thing
trick?
I need to do to become a bestseller? And I'm like, there isn't one, John.
No, but
I say I've always known that there's no hope, and it's all completely pointless. Yeah. Whereas you just keep hanging on to this idea that there's something that can help you.
I think I've had an epiphany. It doesn't exist. You just have to do some writing. That's how you learn. That's how you get good.
Oh, I see. That's the bit I'm still not keen on. But yeah, you're right. You are dead right. It's like anything else. It's like riding a bike, isn't it? Something you can read about riding a bike.
Yeah.
Till the cows come home, and you can know all the bits, and you can learn all about the bits of the bike or how are you riding different, but unless you get on, you just got to get on the bike.
Or watching YouTube videos of golfers, it's not going to help you. I swear to God.
Oh, been there, done that. Yeah. And then the trouble is, this is very similar, isn't it? Yeah, you go, and then you go on the golf course the next time, go, right, haha, I've got all this sorted then. And of course you haven't. It's still a bit shit.
In some ways, it's kind of a good reason for people, having said, listen to Sun Yi's podcast, it's a good reason to give up on all those other writing podcasts and just listen to ours, because at least in ours, you get to feel a little bit superior for a while.
Yeah, that's true. I mean?
That is very true. That's the service that we provide.
Absolutely.
You know you're doing better than us.
Things are going badly, but I'll tell you what. Yeah, that's why we're here. That's why we're here.
You're welcome.
Speaking of making mistakes, we are going to speak to Howard Mittelmark, who co-wrote, along with Sandra Newman, How Not to Write a Novel. 200 mistakes to avoid at all costs if you ever want to get published, which was published back in 2009, but obviously everything in it still very much is true.
Mm.
And if you are rattling some words off for NaNoWriMo, then it's probably not a bad... Well, you're saying... Actually, no, on your advice, John, don't read the book.
Just crack on and write.
Just get writing. Yeah. I'm not sure about that now.
No, just listen to the podcast. It's like a condensed version. It's not actually.
Yeah.
It's not.
No, it's well. It is well worth getting the book just to have on the side and dip in and out of, actually.
Actually, that's true, because it is in...
So it doesn't take much of your time.
Yeah, it's in little bits. You can read a little bit while you're on the loo, can't you? In between your word count.
So yeah, so we thought, well, what a great idea to speak to Howard, pick his brains a bit, and talk about his journey as well,
yep.
because he's done editing as well as writing. He's massively experienced. If you look at the sort of the blurb on How Not to Write a Novel, it says that Guardian Award shortlisted novelist Sandra Newman and veteran editor Howard Mittelmark have distilled 30 years of teaching, editing and writing and reviewing fiction into a hilarious and liberating guide that is a perfect read for anyone who's ever laughed at a badly written piece of prose and for anyone who's ever penned yeah. one and doesn't want to again.
So if you don't want to be the person that we're laughing at, you might want to have a little listen to this.
Right, anyway, we should probably talk about writing.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, are you guys, let me understand you, are you guys published? I heard you talking about your own books. I listened to your bad writing episode.
That's all of them, Howard.
No, this was titled Bad Writing. Yeah, yeah. You were reading, I was proud of myself. I recognized which was the good and which was the bad almost every time.
Oh, very good.
We were testing each other.
As you should, yeah.
Oh, nice move.
No, I mean, the reason the podcast started is that we are three procrastinating losers, really, in terms of the writing thing. Undoubtedly talented, Howard. We've had successful copywriting careers in the advertising world and won arms full of awards.
We have pretensions.
Well, are all of you copywriters?
Yeah, we were. Yeah, at one point. We're now all voiceovers. Yeah. Although Dave does do copywriting now as well to confuse things. But yeah, so we...
Oh, interesting. Yeah, there was something about voiceovers you talked about. Yeah. That's a good transition to make.
Yeah,
yeah. From
writing the words to reading the words. Less work for more money, in effect.
Right, exactly. So in that case, you're not losers. I mean, flailing away at novels, you know.
Yeah. But in terms of finishing anything, you know, weighty or venerable of any description, not so much. So that was the draw of the podcast, was that we'd chivy each other on, bully each other a little bit in a nice way, and kind of get ourselves producing something, like actually finishing something and saying, let's actually...
And how has that worked out?
Well, I mean, in many ways, no, it has. We're learning a lot from the people we have on and stuff. We have actually.
Good.
We have found that the podcast has taken over. Yeah.
Right, of course.
Yeah.
So it's procrastinating. It's just professionally procrastinating.
Yeah, now it's not procrastinating. Exactly. It's just not really having the time as much as because we're spending the time on the podcast.
But having said that, we probably have written more we had, you know, the previous 10 years. So
we've set ourselves a lot of tasks, and I've entered a handful of like little competitions and stuff.
Oh, that's
so
good.
Actually flexing the muscles rather than just sitting there thinking, I should write something.
Like the Bulwer Lytton competition? I noticed you talking about that. Did you enter that one?
Which one was that one?
The worst first sentence, but they were magnificently bad first sentences. You have to be very good to do those.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, I thought I did actually enter one that was about that was judged on the quality of the first sentence. So I thought you were just mocking me. I thought you'd heard my story with my good first sentence and were subtly telling me that.
I would never mock you.
Telling me it should be in that one.
No, I would not mock somebody who's going to be editing my tape. That would be a bad move.
Wise indeed. Always be nice to the waiter.
Yep.
Right, anyway, I'll try again now, shall we? Shall we actually... that was kind of about writing, so we did get somewhere. Howard, welcome to the Failing Writers Podcast.
Thank you.
You have put many hours into trying to prevent people from being failing writers, I would say.
I have. I have built a professional career around that.
Yeah, with your book that brought you to my attention was How Not to Write a Novel. And I saw and thought, well, if there's anything I need to learn... It's definitely how not to write a novel. And then I thought, hold on a minute. I've not been writing a novel for bloody years. I'm an expert in this.
No. That's how to not write a novel. This is how not to write a novel. Very different. Yeah.
So, I mean, just for the listeners, give us a little, what's it all about? The title is relatively self-explanatory, but put a little meat on the bones.
Well, okay, yes. How Not to Write a Novel is a collection of all the mistakes that myself and my co-author see beginning writers make all the time. And this isn't unique to us. The point here is that every editor that is buying novels recognizes all these mistakes immediately because it happens so many times. So the book is hopefully an amusing collection of demonstrating these things so that you can spot them in your own writing.
Yeah.
And in fact, what it's best for, I think, is after you've written your novel. It's really good for the editing stage. You don't want to go into something saying, oh, don't do this, don't do that, don't do that. You want to go into something getting everything down on paper that you can or on screen, and then go through it and see what's working and what's not.
Yeah,
so that's what this is for.
Yeah, that's a good point. It is like an editor's guide, actually. I'd not thought of it like that. Mm. Yeah.
Right.
How many pointers are there in there?
Honestly, I have no idea. I imagine...
Just make a number up then.
What happened was it says 200 mistakes to avoid at all costs, but we had nothing to do with that. The publisher decided that.
Yeah.
And I assume they asked some intern to count them. And it's
I was just going to say, some intern's been sat there going, I think it's 198.
Yeah,
fine, we'll say 200.
They
then.
Didn't come back to us and ask us to write more and did not cut any, so I don't know. I don't know, but there's a lot.
Well, I think we concluded when we did that episode about bad writing, I think we concluded that there are a lot of ways of messing up a book.
There are.
Getting a
there
book
are.
Right is a lot more difficult, but messing it up has hundreds and hundreds
but,
of ways.
But, you know, there are infinite ways to get it right, too. I mean, it's hard, you know, if you think about it, every person's going to turn out a different book and some of them are going to be good. So, no, there are infinite things you can write that will be great. You know, but of course there are many things. But the point is that you can't predict the good things that people are going to write, but you can predict the bad things because it's sort of a gravity well, you know, everybody gets drawn to make because we're all taking in the same things. We're all inspired to write from the same books that we read and unfortunately the movies we see and the TV we watch. And I've got nothing against TV or movies, but there is a problem when you think that you know how to write a story and all you do is get it from TV and movies.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who try to write books without reading books and that would be a problem. Mm.
I started counting all the things not to do that I've been guilty of in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And then I gave up because there were so many of them.
Well, but it doesn't mean there's nothing in here that somebody can't get away with.
Yeah.
There's nothing we say don't do that somebody who's good enough can do and make you stand up and clap, you know?
Well, I was going to say that it does depend, doesn't it? Sometimes how you do something. And in my defense, some of those things that you're not supposed to do, they weren't especially extreme examples.
Right.
They were seldom. They were mild. I call them mild tendencies. That's what I'm going
to
call
something to keep an eye on. That's
exactly.
All.
Exactly. What about you? Are you prone to any of the things
you
know that you ought not to do?
Sure.
You just can't help
yourself.
Sure.
I don't, when I'm writing, and I don't write that much. I don't think of myself as mostly a writer, but I've published a couple of novels and a number of nonfiction books. And I used to ghostwrite, too, so I did a bunch of books then.
Mm.
Yes, of course I am. But I have an awareness of it, and I go through the book again, and I spot it. I just did this. I'm working on a new novel, and I spent the first 40 pages giving the main character early years when the story takes place, you know, when he's an adult, you know, when he's older. And but I wanted to explore that. That's what called out to me. And maybe I'll use some of that material later and maybe I won't. But now I know all about him and that will be useful.
Yeah.
But I know enough not to make that the first chapter of the book because nobody wants to read that but me.
As it says in the book, Howard, the benign tumor is a scene, chapter or entire section of a novel that can be neatly excised without any harm to the surrounding organism.
Right. Correct. That's right. That's the benign tumor.
And finishes with, I like this bit. And before you object, no, they are not worth saving, even if they have my most beautiful writing in them. Such passages are like baby pictures, endlessly fascinating to the parent, of passing interest to friends and relatives, and of no interest to anyone else at all.
That's very good. I like that.
Yeah.
You have to remember, I wrote this 15 years ago, you know, and I haven't spent a lot of time reading it since then. I didn't remember that. That's very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. Well done.
Yeah, it was. It was clever.
Hey, do you know what I want to ask about the book? So through the book, for the listeners, you kind of use, you actually write the mistakes out.
Right.
There's sort of a narrative running through it that's kind of a pretend snippets of a novel.
Snippets of a number of novels, but
that kind of that are sometimes linked and what have you, aren't they? So they kind of sit together.
Yeah.
But it's very much an over the top kind of like really showing the the mistake in its natural habitat.
Yep, yep.
And I just wondered, what was it like writing those? Was it really good fun having to be really bad, like putting really like...
You know, if I was writing it
massively
by
clumsy
things. Was great. If I was writing it by myself, maybe not as much, but I was writing this with my co-author, Sandy, and I had more fun writing those than I've had doing anything else. You know, it was...
Yeah, no, they were great to read.
Yeah. What we mostly did is try to make each other laugh. You know, we were just trying to top each other with those. So, yeah, that was great fun. And that is, you know, that's writing itself. That was the best writing I did that year. That was great.
The bad writing was the best writing.
Yes, exactly.
It was just there was some little, lovely little pointless callbacks and threads through it that just made me chuckle.
Right, that's right, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? There was like a bit where it says, "I can't believe that only 2 weeks after our wedding you would do this," Cynthia cried. "You had such a promising future with your family's hydraulics firm. And you quit to working ergonomics without even discussing it with me." And just the ridiculousness of the content.
Yeah, I actually remember there's one great line in there that we actually quote to each other still.
Right.
It was at some point he was going to become VP of hydraulics downhill and he could put up his feet and coast. You know, this is what we're aiming. This is what we're aiming for here.
But
we want to put
that's
up
what
our
I mean.
Feet and
it's
coast.
Brilliant that because it's meant to be bad, that at no point do you come up with something and go, well, we can't put that in. It's fine.
And then there's a lot of foreign terms too, but people don't get them. One of the I don't know what language I can use on your podcast,
anything.
And I might not be able to pronounce this correctly because I read it mostly. Deus ex machina.
Oh, that's one of my
ex machina. Yeah.
Yeah, God from the box. You know, and it's when you end a novel or you pull somebody out of a scene by just bringing in something that wasn't there before.
Yeah.
Just a plane, a helicopter appears and lets you escape. And that's known from Greek plays as the god from the sky who comes down and just fixes everything. And we said, this is called, don't do this. This is called Deus Ex Machina, which is French for "Are you fucking kidding me?" And the first editor we had sent back a note that said, "Isn't this Latin?" And just did not get it, you know. Fortunately, he left for another publisher, and we got an editor that got everything.
You would get that feedback and think, is he joking on the joke? Surely he must.
This guy was not, but he bought it, you know, so, you know, my hat's like, I appreciate this guy. He bought our book.
Yeah.
He supported us for a year. Yeah. So, but he didn't get our jokes. That's all. I think he expected it to be a lot more serious at that time. You know,
do you know what it made me wonder, the book and those extreme examples, having been an editor, I'm guessing you've seen a decent amount of very bad writing in your time.
Yes.
Have any of the manuscripts that you've been sent over, have they ever come anywhere close to the god-awful examples that you've written for the book?
Absolutely.
Wow.
No.
Yes. I mean, mostly not, but when we talk about in the section on sentences and how not to use adjectives and adverbs, you know, people make mistakes. Sometimes I can't even sort them out. But yes, mostly this is exaggerated, but... there's an awareness as we're writing these, obviously, and we're leaning toward the bad. So it's worse, but, you know, there's something of its nature that is just as bad. So, yes, people are that bad.
That somehow just gives me joy. It's just good to hear.
Yeah, and so do I. And you know what? I love those. I love that stuff, and I enjoy those books. You know, people are really trying. They want to write books, and it's like, well, you know, that's great. Do it.
Yeah.
Do your best.
I have to say, I have read books that I would say, you know, you would sort of objectively say these are not well-written books, but still enjoyed them.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, I enjoy almost everything I read on some level.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes just because they're bad and you're asking yourself, why is this bad? But it's kind of enjoyable as well in some strange way. Or the story might be good, but the writing's not necessarily good.
Well, that's absolutely right. You know, people read for different things, and we're in a different publishing landscape than we were when we wrote this book. And, you know, people can put their books out in the world, and they'll find people. But the thing is, if you want to write a good book, you can't just read that stuff. You have to read stuff that's that's beyond you, larger than you. You have to improve yourself. So, I mean, I know that there are communities online where they read each other's self-published romances, you know, and that's what they read and that's what they talk about, and it makes them happy, and I'm happy for them. You know, go on, but you're never going to write anything. And this isn't just romances. I'm just picking them out because they have a, more of a community than most genres. You're just never going to reach further than that because you're reading a...
You're in a little echo chamber, aren't you, of your genre?
Yes, exactly. And it's not just an echo chamber. It's a Xerox of a Xerox of a Xerox. You remember Xeroxes. You're old enough for that, right?
Yeah.
Because they were inspired to write these by books that they read. And then they make their version of it, which is a little fuzzier, and then they're only reading those, so it gets fuzzier and fuzzier, you know? So you should be reading outside of your genre. You should be reading over your head. You should be, you know, you should learn how the language works beyond the way it's used in your particular genre, because, you know, language is more flexible than that. You can use it in different ways. And you find that out when you read people who aren't like you.
So which writers do you really admire, Howard? Who are your gods?
Oh, God, I don't know.
That's such a hard question. It sounds like such a simple question.
Yeah, right. Who do I really admire? Who, you know, every once in a while I'll read a... You know,
sounds to me, from what you've said, I would imagine Dan Brown will be up there for you.
That's very funny, yeah.
E.L. James,
Dan,
again.
I couldn't read more than two pages of the Dan Brown book, although he's one of the people we make fun of extensively in How Not to Write a Novel.
Yeah.
You know, he hurt my ears. Reading him actually hurt my ears.
I like that, Howard. Make it stop. Somebody make it stop. Just shut the book, Howard. I can't. It's so bad.
Part of what I do is, I don't want to say I have perfect pitch, but I have a very sensitive ear for language, you know? So when I read stuff like that, it hurts.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I kind of, the question I expected was, what book have you read the most time, you know, what book have you reread the most times? And I had an answer for that, so I guess this is who do I admire.
Yeah, let's go with that one.
Do your own question. If our questions aren't good enough, Howard, just do your own.
Yeah, let's go with that. I only read Middlemarch for the first time, say, 10 years ago.
Oh, okay.
And I've read it 3 times since then. But I've also read Robert Heinlein's The Moon is a Harsh Mistress maybe 15 times since I was a kid. So the stuff that I like just, you know, I read all of the Reacher novels until he handed it off to his brother they got bad.
Right. Yeah.
I just found Jo Walton. I don't know if you've heard of Jo Walton. She's she might be Scottish. A Christopher Priest is amazing. I've been on a Christopher Priest kick. I've read maybe 6 of his novels in the last year. And Nina Allen wrote a book called, what was it? The Rift? That was just amazing. I admire lots of people. I don't know how to answer that.
So you practice what you preach and read outside different genres and all kinds. So I guess that's...
I read back to the 19th century, you know, the 19th century, which I didn't do as a kid. I did that as an adult, you know.
You make that sound like you've got some kind of hard limit on how far back you will read. As if it's
it's true, actually.
I'm not doing any Chaucer. You can get lost in
No, Chaucer, I actually... Why did I read Chaucer? I read Chaucer for some reason. He's entertaining. But no, I don't enjoy that. I don't enjoy reading Middle English. I'm not fluent in it. And the 18th century, guys, my God. Oh, actually, that's not true. I really enjoyed Daniel Defoe. I enjoyed, what is it, Moll Flanders? That was a fun book.
Yeah.
But I much prefer Jane Austen. Yeah. And as you get closer... that's another thing. You're not asking this question, but an interesting thing is...
We're going to edit all these questions, the good questions you're coming up with.
Right.
We're going to edit them in. I'm going to be asking them all.
Yeah, do that. Do that. I would appreciate it, because I don't want to sound like I'm just going off on my own tangents here.
That's fine.
Okay,
what's the next question I'm asking?
I don't know how you'd frame this question. It's just a point that it's a thing that I noticed and a point that I make that... Because after we wrote this book, we wrote a book called Read This Next, and then we wrote a book on Western literature. And people talk about the classics, people who think that, oh, they were better writers in the 19th century than now. But no, it's only that we only read the good stuff, you know? They don't read all the stuff that didn't get published.
No, no, it's like 1980s pop music, isn't it?
There's a lot
of drops. Exactly.
Everyone looks back and goes, oh, hey, you see, all that.
So good, yeah.
And they reel off all these amazing songs and bands and things. And think, hold on a minute. You go back. Yep. There was some absolute crap knocking around.
There really
was. I think
was.
It's the same with anything, isn't it? It goes through the passage of time. It's rose-tinted glasses, isn't it?
So, yeah, I do read. I don't read much past the 19th century, but I keep an eye on what's being published now. And it's part of my job. I need to know what people are reading. And in fact, I'm kind of intrusive on the subway. I'll be looking at, you know, the books that people, the few people that still have books, you know, as opposed to e-readers.
Yeah.
But I need to know that to do my work. I need to know how people are writing now and what publishers are buying. So I read a lot of contemporary literature, and I love science fiction, so I read a lot of science fiction.
You've worked for lots of different publishing houses, and now you're purely freelance.
I have been for a long time, yeah. I've only been on staff on a couple of small publishing houses. I wrote for magazines before that. I was on staff at Penthouse for a little while. I edited Penthouse letters.
That must have been an experience.
Which is how I got into porn. I wrote for business magazines. My first job.
Howard, come back up. Two steps backwards. Yeah.
The Penthouse letters,
What was that like? How did that come about?
I'll tell you how it came about. It was 1989, and I had sold an op-ed to the Times, and it was well received. And I was about to have a child, and I had been trying to make a living as a book reviewer. And I don't know that anybody could ever do that. I was doing like three books a week, but I was getting $30 a pop. So it just was not working. So I started, when I found out I was going to become a father, I thought, okay, it's time. I got to get a goddamn job again. And I sent in an application. This is when you could look in the back of the newspaper. And there was a Penthouse was looking for an editor. And I sent in an application. And it turns out that the guy I worked for just had this real New York Times fetish. You know, he really wanted, the whole time I knew him, he was trying to get his daughter's wedding announced in the Times. And he was just so impressed. Like, he sent my resume with the op-ed around to all his other editors saying, why aren't you doing this? Which did not make them really amenable to my arrival. That's what I did. I had a kid coming, so I took a job at Penthouse. And what I did there was edit three of their lower tier magazines, one of which was Penthouse Letters. And the answer to the question is, we did not write them. Yes, they all came in through the mail.
Wow.
But are they real? No. You know, people made most of that shit up. And a lot of my job was turning it into English, you know, making it into English sentences. And a lot of the return addresses were college dorms and jails, you know. And another job we had for our Canadian edition was to take all the animals out. You know, you couldn't have children in the U.S. or Canada, but in America you could have animals. Well, you know. So do you have any other questions about Penthouse
probably
letters?
Move on now.
Well, I mean, that's opened up a few questions, to be honest. Yeah.
Okay.
What have the Canadians got against that? Are they not allowed to? Is that a problem Canadians have?
Maybe there's more of it up there. Maybe they're fucking sheep.
That's what it felt to me like. They may be touchy about
it. Yeah, exactly. It makes sense to me.
Know, people are just going around fondling moose or something like that.
There's a lot of empty territory up there, you know, so who knows what they're getting up to.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, so I was saying, yes, I work for that magazine.
Yeah, move on from the Canadian bestiality.
A number of other magazines. My first job in book publishing was at a literary agency.
Did that feel like a step down after Penthouse?
It was a step down because I took that job. I lost money doing that, but I wanted to move into books, and that was the job that I got. And that's where I started seeing slush. That's where I started reading bad manuscripts. And I learned to, you know, I started recognizing that stuff. And from there, what happened then? I was at a small publisher, and my boss, the editor-in-chief, an agent had been asking for a writer to ghostwrite something. This became my first agent, and I ghost wrote a bestseller. he just kind of kept on feeding me his clients to rewrite their books. I did that for a while. And then did I have another staff job? I only had one staff job after that. It was during the first dot-com boom. And I just wanted to work online. You know, I just wanted to see what that was like. And I edited a website in 99, I think. And that's the last time I was on staff. And since then, I've been editing books and writing books. And
having never worked with an editor before, give us an idea how you actually work. So I hand over my manuscript to you. Is it like big structural edits first, and then you sort of send me back, and then I go away and write? And
okay.
How does it work?
You send me your book, and I'm going to read it a couple of times. And I'm going to make notes in the margins. Like, it'll jump out. Like, as I'm starting, I'll notice how you use language, you know, if you're misusing idioms and stuff like that, if I need to pay attention on that level. But I'm also looking at the story and seeing how the story works. And almost always, you know, every once in a while, I'll get a book and say, well, I got to give this guy his money back. You know, I can't, he doesn't need my help. And then halfway through it, you know, all of a sudden he forgets a whole character or he introduces something that just doesn't work. There's always something in the plot, or it just happens so often that what the character does doesn't make sense, or they forgot that they did something before, or there is no ending. It doesn't end. So, yeah, I'll what I'll do is write up an editorial letter, which might be anywhere from, like, I don't know, what's 8 pages, a few thousand words, to 20 pages, discussing the characters and the plot. Right. And I'll point out the places where there are weaknesses or actual mistakes or things you... There'll sometimes be things I'll just say, no, you cannot do this.
I'm putting my foot down.
Readers will not read further than this. They will stop when they come across this because it doesn't make sense.
Or when John writes, and it was all a dream.
Right, well, there's that. But you can pull that off. You can make that work, you know, because you're doing it self. You can do it self-consciously. Everybody knows you're winking, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, the editorial letter will discuss the characters, the shape of the book. Sometimes I'll get into the underlying themes if somehow they're in conflict with what you're actually... Like, sometimes you'll be saying opposite things and you need to bring those together. And then I'll just point out all the glitches that you need to address and talk about your style. And so you get back a long letter, and also the note... I'll fix things as I'm going through. Because we're working in Word, it's really easy for me to fix things and show you what the problem is.
Yeah,
right, yeah.
Highlight.
Benign tumors work on every level. There are sometimes there are paragraphs, sometimes there are sentences. They just don't need to be there. We know the thing you're saying. I have a theory that... I can't prove it in a lab, but I call it page value, right? And page value works like this. A reader comes to a book for a reason. They want to get a certain... They might be reading it to be entertained. They might be reading it to be excited or moved. Or it could just be the beauty of your writing, whatever it is. But they need a certain amount of value on every page. And when they read too many pages that don't deliver that value, the humor or the style or the plot mechanics, they'll stop reading. Now, you can build up some momentum, you know. You can have something really exciting happen, like a cliffhanger, and the reader will give you a few pages because you still have that accumulated page value. But if it gets spread too thin, their attention will wander, you know?
And there is a point in so many books where that happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where you just can't, you know, you might race through the first third, and then you find yourself just either falling asleep or just not being able to get past it for some reason.
Yeah, and I hear people talking about how they feel like they have to finish books. Just don't, you know? Unless it's an assignment, unless you're reviewing it or you're in college, you know, don't finish the goddamn book. There are so many books, you know.
I always have to somehow. I don't know why. I feel like I need to somehow honor some kind of contract. It's ridiculous.
Okay, well,
but I always do that. I do that with films as well, even if it's terrible. I always think, well, it'll change in a minute.
Well, but then there's something there that's drawing you on, or you would have stopped,
yeah, maybe.
You know?
Or I'm just an idiot.
You honor... Yeah. I don't think so, because I do that with TV series. I watch the ends of TV series that,
yeah, yeah.
You know, you'd think, well, that wasn't a great episode, you know? So, yeah. But you honored your contract when you paid for the book. That's the contract. The writer wrote, you pay him.
That
is the only contract.
That's all the writer cares about as well.
Well, not anymore.
That's not true. That's not true. I'm only
kidding.
Well,
no. I am a great exponent of that. These days, everybody's just, I am a writer. I'm a noble writer. No, you're a parasite on society. We don't need you. You know, there are more than enough books for everybody. There are people that are hungry. Go help them if you want to do something important. No, we are indulging ourselves by being writers. We don't want regular jobs. We want to sleep on your couch and have you feed us. You know?
Sure, Howard, don't tell everyone.
Writing should be a disreputable profession.
Come on, we got our secrets.
It should not be admired. If you go back to the 18th century, you can see that all these guys were just scurrilous. They were sleazy, you know?
Yeah.
And we're losing that tradition, and it really bugs me. It bugs me, all these young people who think that, you know, that writers are supposed to be moral paradigms. No, not only are they not supposed to do everything right according to what you believe, just being a writer says they're not that. So,
that is a great point. I don't think anyone's made that point on the podcast before.
No, I
haven't dared.
I'm not sure which point. That writers are scum. I haven't looked at this book in a while, but I was looking at it in preparation for the podcast. Here's something. This is from the afterword. We hope that you have come to see us as more than writing manual hacks. We hope that we have been your liberators, the Spartacuses, the Che Guevara of writing manual hacks. You know, we wrote this book to make money. Yes, we want to help people. And yes, we want to entertain people. But, you know, if you're a writer, I don't know. I could be wrong. Other people don't feel this way. I know that.
I think there's an angle into what you're saying, which opens an interesting point, though. I think there is. I think we live in a culture at the minute where people will disagree with what a writer has written about a character or a character's behavior. And that always troubles me a little, that people aren't able to separate the fact that someone's writing an objectionable, I don't know, whatever, racist or misogynist character, and that's who that character is. And you can't judge that character not that book's terrible. It's got nasty people in it. And it just seems like a bit of a weird slant on it. That you're right, there's some kind of like...
I mean, clearly if you're glorifying them, that's slightly different.
Right. Yeah,
but we're not talking about that. We're just talking about bad...
If it's some call to arms for...
Right. Yeah. Does the writer contain it, or does it contain the writer? Yes, absolutely. You know, if it's the writer's actually, you should be able to tell the difference.
It seems that line's got a little bit blurred.
Yeah, it's ridiculous right now, and I don't know what's going to happen. You know, it's affecting fiction.
Well, there was a story recently about, and I don't know if it made it over into the States or not, about Roald Dahl's work being sanitized.
Oh yeah. It has been deracinated. Yes.
Yeah.
He was a nasty bugger, wasn't he? He was an awful guy, as far as I know.
Yeah, a bit old school, I think it's fair
to
say.
I don't know what to make of that. I understand why some people would want kids to read stuff without, but it seems kind of ridiculous. But that's also getting back far enough in time that everybody did think things that we object to now.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people who object to that haven't actually read it, haven't read the new version, because the new version isn't actually that different. Like, it's really not that different.
I think what made me think was, my initial reaction was, well, that's ridiculous. And some of the changes that you see in it just seem like so, like, a terrible, overly modern, snowflakey... Do you mean, on, seriously? But then there was someone comparing the old version, which wasn't actually the old first version, it was already edited, and sort of the references to things like the Oompa Loompas were just horrendously, massively racist, they were offensive. So this is almost like a second change, and you think, well, it's difficult, isn't it? So you can't look at stuff through the prism of time without in isolation. It has to be
right. I know.
It becomes a really difficult argument, actually, in terms of
it is. It's complex and convoluted. Mm. And also, though, you know, this stuff isn't the Bible. Mm. You know, we do not worship this stuff. I mean, it was edited when he wrote it. Somebody edited it. You know, so there were changes made then. So what? Yeah.
Well, the Bible's been edited thousands of times.
That's very true.
As well,
the Bible is a terrible example. Yeah. Well,
no, I know. I was trying to think of something.
That's been tinkered with beyond belief.
Yeah, I was trying to think of something that we're not supposed to change. But yes, absolutely. And it's been through many languages and cultures. But the point is that, yes, it all changes. So what's the big deal? But I want to get back to that. Yes, the racist character. If clearly the racist character represents the author's point of view, then you can object to the book. But you're absolutely right. People want all the characters in books to meet their moral standards. And I know for a fact that people are avoiding writing things because they know that will happen. That is not good.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting
it. That brings me on to your most recent book, Written Out, because that is about a character who is basically despicable.
Oh, come on. And he's a good guy.
Come on.
No, you're right. No, I mean,
I was going to say there are obviously some autobiographical elements to that book, but hopefully not too many. But it's obviously about an editor who also writes books and he ghostwrites as well. Tell us a little bit about the evolution of that book and why you wanted to write it.
Well, first of all, let me just say that after I heard your episode on bad writing, I kind of regretted sending it in because I didn't know how you were going to take it.
Well, it's funny, Howard. We're doing another episode on bad writing. We're just going to ask you if we could use...
right. You use that, please. You know, the evolution of the book was... I found myself in a situation like that, you know, in that I'm married to somebody who's a much more successful writer than I am. She was getting way ahead of me, so I wanted to write another novel. And two, I wanted to have some fun with that situation. Mm. So I just threw this character, you know, I did not, you know, do any of that stuff, obviously. I didn't kill anybody. And I also didn't cheat on my wife in that situation, and she didn't throw me out. But I suppose that I took the elements of my life and I said, okay, this is what happens. It's the worst thing I can imagine, that you'd have to move back into your mother's basement. I hope neither of you guys are living in your mother's basement.
I do actually live in John's mum's basement, yeah.
Is that right? Well, if you switch, it's fine.
Right, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Don't tell her.
But what I did with that book is I just kind of gave it a push. And then in every situation, I decided what is the worst thing that can happen to him / funniest thing that can happen to him.
Yeah, yeah. Great.
And that's just what I did. I just kept on pushing him into situations, having him make bad decisions. And at a certain point, I had to start him digging his way out of it. So that's what I do. That's the evolution of that book. I had fun writing it.
It does start out like it's almost like seemingly quite serious, like a serious literary book to begin with. And then suddenly it becomes much more, or maybe not that suddenly, but it becomes much more like self-consciously farcical. And weirdly, the more depressing the story gets, the funnier it gets. Was that like a conscious thing? You wanted to start at a certain level and then go downhill fast?
Well, also, though, what that is, that's his voice. You know, what you're listening to is his voice, and that's how he thinks of himself. I am a serious writer, you know? I am above these people around me. And that... I mean, that contrast is amusing, that all these ridiculous things are happening to him and he's just really doing really stupid things while speaking as if, you know, he's above everything around him. It entertained me, you know. And also I was able to indulge my worst, like, I would never, he's pretentious as hell. But, you know, I have that, like, I know better not to write that pretentiously, but he doesn't. So I got to do that, if you see what I mean.
Which is actually a very enjoyable thing to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Is to use long words.
Right.
Have you ever written, kind of still on that book, have you ever written a screenplay?
No, I have not.
There's a very funny bit in the book where the main character, Roger,
who
is more used to writing books, he talks about writing screenplays. And it really made me laugh because he says, how hard can it be? They're short, they're 120 pages, they're 50% white space, and there's no need to describe the people or describe anything, really, in all their specifics. It's like some sort of magic, an alternate universe where things are summoned into existence by speaking their names. Ext, Woods, Day. Done. Somebody else's job.
Yeah.
Thought that was brilliant. Very good.
Thank you. Thank you. It does seem that way, though, from my perspective.
I say it's funny because it's true.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Ta-da, Woods. Brilliant.
I thought a nice little bit on it was where Roger is murdering the old lady.
one of many old ladies.
And
yeah.
I just like the I don't know why, I just like the line where he said, "I put on my clothes because it seemed wrong to do it naked."
Right.
Just his conception of yeah. I mean, obviously, I'm going to murder her, but
it's a good laugh.
Right.
It'd
right.
be a bit weird, wouldn't it, if I did it in the buff?
Yeah. Thanks for reading the book, by the way. You didn't have to do that.
No, it was a pleasure, mate.
Oh, good. Good. Pleasure. Failing writers, we got to stick together, you know.
That's exactly. What we do. Read each other's stuff. Who else is going to read it?
We bring people on, no matter their level of success, and slowly pull them down to our level. By the end of the interview, they leave just feeling miserable and failures, but it perks us up a bit.
I would like it if Roger was your mascot.
there's probably something in there. Yeah. Well, Howard, thank you so much for your time. That's been a really lovely chat.
Yeah,
really
thanks.
Lovely. Yeah, I've enjoyed myself too. Thank you for inviting me on.
Thank you for sharing your wisdom and your experience with us. Really appreciate it.
Well, wisdom, I wouldn't go that far, but you're welcome to it.
Howard, thank you
very much.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed myself.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too.
Oh, what a lovely chat.
Yeah, brilliant.
I genuinely loved what he said about writing not being a noble profession. About writers being parasites on society.
It's nice to hear that, isn't it?
It is. I think deep down, we might have all thought that, but we've not really wanted to.
Well, there's a lot of people wandering around, isn't there, with delusions of grandeur with it and wanting to be...
highfalutin ideas.
Well, none of that. Yeah. None of that around here. No.
No.
Brilliant.
That's brought us down to earth with a bang, hasn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. That was great.
Genius.
Right. Well...
hopefully that's inspired you to crack on with your whip and amaze the world.
Yeah.
Or it's made you want to go out and get a proper job, become a care worker or something.
Yeah.
But either way, that's got to be a win.
Next week, we're going to have a little review of some of the entries for our competition.
Oh, yeah.
Our flash fiction competition.
Yeah, and we're hopefully going to speak to Manuela St. Thomas, the winner.
So, join us next week for a little bit of story time, really, wouldn't it? Just be chock full of great stories.
Yeah, that'd be lovely. And then, Tommy, please, can we go back to putting out bi-weekly podcasts?
Then we'll have a week off.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
So we can actually do some writing.
I think we'll have done 9 episodes in a row.
Well, that's a bit stupid, isn't it?
It's a bit stupid. That's exactly what we said we wouldn't do at the beginning.
It's ridiculous. I mean, we didn't want to do that. The listeners didn't want that to happen. No one wanted that to happen.
How did it even happen? I actually genuinely
good for anyone.
We must love doing
literally
this
literally benefits no one.
Yeah.
Apologies to everyone.
Yeah, I'm sorry, guys.
Yeah, we'll try and limit our mad ramblings from here on in.
At some point, also, Tommy, we actually need to get some writing done. And I think, unless I dreamt it, we've officially set each other a challenge of finishing like a first draft of our whips. By the end of November.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, that's official. And that would definitely help, wouldn't it? Not doing a podcast every
week. It certainly would. So, frees up a bit of time.
Yeah.
So can you stop twittering on then so we can actually...
Yeah, I'll shut up and...
There's just no need. Yeah. It's too much.
Listen, everybody, thank you for listening. Lovely hanging out with you.
Just say goodbye.
Crack on and goodbye.
Yeah. Oh, finally we got there. Goodbye.
Hello.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone?
Thank
Lovely.
You.
And we will try and remember to drop you a link to it.
Yeah, we will.
And what have you as well, so you can have a little listen.
Oh, you mean before you broadcast it, you'll let me go over it?
Yeah, I mean, we're not going to let you change anything, but you can listen to it. Yeah. Yeah, that's cool.
Oh, really? Will you let me change one thing?
Editor, always an editor, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? Just want to change everything.
No, we'll make you sound amazing.
Okay.
Tommy's good at that.
Fair enough. Thank you. Please do that. Please make me sound more intelligent than I am. I'd appreciate it.
We do it with ourselves every week, so that's cool. Yeah, no problem.